Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome this morning on the 5th of December to Faith Radio Mornings. You're listening to the show, part of the Faith Radio Network, that covers a lot of the news and the special interest topics of the day from a Christian perspective as we gather together as a listening audience from North Dakota, South Dakota, from Waterloo, Iowa, to Madison, Wisconsin, Duluth, Hartford, Connecticut, streaming through our app all around the country as brothers and sisters in our faith to keep our eyes together fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. We'll cover these topics from a distinctly Christian perspective each morning on the show. And if you listen regularly, you know I'm the host of the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and I'm joined in studio by Rachel Sutton, who is running all the buttons this morning and playing the Christmas music that we're going to play over the next several weeks, going in and out of breaks as we celebrate this wonderful season in which our Savior was born. And of course, Paul Perot in the newsroom, who stacks my desk each morning with all kinds of news. We get to a lot of it left aside. We can't quite get to everything in the 2 hours, but we'll do the best we can to keep you updated on the events of the day. And of course, what we see happening today is the funeral of George H.W. Bush, and he'll be eulogized by his son, George W. Bush. And of course, the event will be attended by many world leaders and former presidents as well. I was glad to see that the Bush family specifically said they wanted to get rid of the rancor, at least for a day, and they didn't want any President Trump bashing or anything along those lines, to celebrate the life and the legacy of George H.W. Bush. And of course, that means a lot of federal offices are closed today. So if you try to go to the post office this morning, that is not going to work out. It will be shuttered for the day. There's no trading on the stock market, and several other offices will be closed for the day. Well, looking forward to our show ahead, we're going to have Drew Griffin up first from Providence Magazine. And Drew and I are going to talk a little bit more about the life and the legacy from an international perspective of President Bush. And we'll also get into some recent updates that happened with the journalist from Saudi Arabia who was murdered in the Turkish embassy, Jamal Khashoggi, because certainly the Congress had a very considerable opinion about what might have happened as they were briefed by the CIA yesterday. And it's pretty certain, at least in their eyes, that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia had a significant role in the killing of Khashoggi. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on President Trump to potentially do something to intervene in the situation. So Drew will talk a lot about that with me coming up next. But before we go there, because it is the Christmas time and because we are following Jesus together, I thought we'd head into break with one of my favorite passages of Scripture, that being Isaiah 9, in which we see the prophetic words of the prophet Isaiah thinking about the future and knowing that at some point in time that people who are walking in great darkness will have seen a great light. Those living in the land of deep darkness, on them a light has shined. For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end, and he will reign on David's throne, and his kingdom will be established and upholded with justice and righteousness from that time on and for forever. And so that is the language we use on Faith Radio Mornings, that we are part of a kingdom that knows no end. Walk-up music for Drew Griffin, who's the managing editor of Providence Magazine, which is a journal that really explores the intersection between Christianity and American foreign policy. So I have Drew on regularly to talk a bit about some of the global events from a Christian perspective. Good morning, Drew.
Hi, good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. I'm curious, you know, sometimes when you're on, Drew, I feel like it's a little bit of Where's Waldo, where you're somewhere in the world eating some kind of foreign food. Are you in Israel now? Or are you somewhere in, you know, Southeast Malaysia? Are you in the States? Where are you, Drew?
I'm in the States. I'm actually in upstate New York right now. So I'm looking at the Catskill Mountains as we speak.
Oh, I'm very jealous, Drew, of that. You know, as it's Advent season, obviously, and participating in Christmas coming up here in just a few weeks, is there any sort of Christmas song that you really just say, boy, when that one comes on, that's the one that really gets my attention?
Yeah, I would have to say for a Christian kind of Christmas anthem, it would be O Holy Night. That's kind of my go-to and my favorite Christian Christmas song.
Yeah, in terms of the lyrics of that song, there is such a rich and deep theological significance in that song. And so we'll play that one coming into break in just a minute. I know Rachel Sutton's on the buttons for you to give you a bit of Oh Holy Night. But lots to get to this morning, of course, today on the program. We see you coming on and talking a little bit about the foreign policy legacy of George H.W. Bush. It's his funeral today. He'll be laid to rest at the National Cathedral. And so give us a sense, Drew, as one who's participated in over a dozen political campaigns and covers this kind of thing regularly. Tell us a little bit more about his foreign policy legacy.
Sure. Well, I think George H.W. Bush really represents one of the last bastions of this greatest generation that led the United States through the latter half of the 20th century, and had this really uniquely Christian and at one time American ideal that to live is to serve others. Right, that you're here and you're placed on this world not just to exist and not just to serve yourself, but to serve others, that we're blessed in order to bless others, whether you have ability or wealth or skill or privilege. And you really see that lived out, in the greatest generation. I saw it lived out in my grandparents. You see it lived out in the life of George H.W. Bush. And so here's a man who was blessed with cultural privilege, blessed with wealth, and blessed with immense ability and courage. And he took all of those things, and very easily, after he was one of the youngest naval aviators in World War II and was shot down and rescued and flew missions, he returned, went to Yale, went down to Texas and started, an oil company basically in Midland, Texas. Could have very easily settled down and blended into the atmosphere there and led a very comfortable life of privilege, and going up to the family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine every summer, and yachting, and just basically disappeared into the fabric of American history. But instead, he leveraged his entire life into public service and serving as a congressman, serving as the ambassador to the United Nations, to the liaison to China, to the director of the CIA, to the vice president, and finally the presidency. And so you really see a man whose life was marked by selfless service that I think was very much informed by his Christian faith.
And certainly, you referenced the greatest generation, Drew, and there's a sense in which in World War II that our nation celebrated together the sacrificial loss and mourned together the sacrificial loss of those who seemed to have a call of service to help protect the world, even though they were going overseas. And then on the heels of that, we had the Vietnam War, which seemed to burst some skepticism that we would get involved in other countries for political gain, political reasons. And so is there a sense in which George Bush brought much more of a spirit of help and humanitarian aid when he went into other countries? Because, again, most people these days, I think that, gosh, the only reason why we're going to help somewhere else is if we can gain something from it.
Right. Well, I think that it's I think you're right. I think that there is always a balancing act there between, the interest of others and our own self-interest. And I think what hopefully, America's interest should be as far as it regards like freedom and liberty abroad, the rule of law, the pursuit of justice, that when we fight for those ideals and we go overseas and we engage in conflicts in order to see those ideals flourish across the world, that there is a little measure that is in our own self-interest, right? The world is a better place. It's an easier place to navigate economically. It's an easier place to trade in, an easier place to exist in if the rule of law is dominating throughout the world, throughout our partners, that there's greater freedom and greater liberty. And so I think what you see with George H.W. Bush is, you know, there are many times when if we're going into the Gulf War, we have economic interests, you know, in the Gulf, and there's a reason why we helped eject Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. But, you know, there's also the greater interest that's served in helping other countries maintain their own self-determination and their own freedom. And so sometimes I think there's a liberal tendency to criticize that if our self-interests overlap with the interests of others, that somehow is wrong, or those things are at odds. And that does not always have to be the case. And I think you saw that throughout the leadership of George H.W. Bush.
Boy, I'll never forget where I was when I first heard word that we had begun to bomb Iraq to go in to unseat Saddam Hussein. I'll never forget where I was when watching the statue of Saddam Hussein come down out of central Iraq. Drew, do you remember covering some of that? And what was your take back in that time?
Well, I remember definitely covering the second Gulf War and watching that kind of unfold. And I think what you saw an immense difference between, of course, the first Gulf War, which was very short and very targeted and had a very kind of limited mission with large international partnership, and then the second Gulf War, which was very protracted, very, very bloody, and oftentimes, you know, criticized for not always having maybe the clearest of objectives. And I think there's a lot of wisdom that you saw in George H.W. Bush in his leadership, in that, you know, as a vet, as one who saw combat, as one who saw friends die in World War II and having kind of lived that life, he was very much informed by that. And you know, very much, I think, it informed his decision-making when sending American troops into battle. And he was not afraid to do that and did that when it was necessary, whether it was Panama or whether it was the Gulf War. But he very much used his judgment, I think, to help protect American lives. And so I think there's an immense difference between the first you know, Iraq War and the second Iraq War.
Yeah, certainly father and son being involved in those consecutive wars back and forth. It was a very targeted effort of George H.W. Bush and seemed to have quite a bit of support of the nation at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And coming after, 9/11, there was just, I think, an immense pressure to get involved in the region. And so, it was very different.
It's Drew Griffin of Providence Magazine. You can go to providencemag.org and check out a lot of the work that's being done, in which Drew and his staff explore the intersection between Christianity and American foreign policy. And Drew, when we come back, let's get into the conversation around the journalists and the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And it certainly seems like increasingly we're having a smoking gun involved with the fact that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was involved in that murder. So we'll talk with more next with Drew Griffin.
Oh, holy night. The stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth.
Yeah, I don't know, Drew. I used to think it was Little Drummer Boy for me, but I hear Oh Holy Night, and it's pretty tough to choose between those two.
Yeah, no, that was beautiful. Thanks for pointing that.
Yeah, so, you know, I asked you in the first segment if you had covered the first Iraq War. I realized I was only about 20 years old then. Drew, are you even alive, or did you cover it at the age of 5, or how did that work out for you?
Okay, yeah, I was like 12, so yeah, I was cognizant of it, but no, it certainly didn't cover it.
Didn't fly you over the plane as a teenager to get involved. Well, there's lots more to get into this morning. I know we saw that there's some updates on the investigation related to the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian journalist who was murdered, apparently by all accounts by the Crown Prince. And we saw some reaction coming out of Congress yesterday in which Bob Corker, having heard some of the evidence, said this.
I have zero question in my mind that the Crown Prince, MBS, ordered the killing, monitored the killing, knew exactly what was happening, planned it in advance. If he was in front of a jury, he would be convicted in 30 minutes guilty.
Yeah, he's hardly alone. Even a staunch defender of the president and Lindsey Graham said that this is a pretty obvious open and shut case. We see on the Democratic side of it and Menendez as well. Just it appears that all the evidence is pointing to the fact that the Crown Prince was intimately involved in the killing of Khashoggi.
Yes, I mean, this has been unfolding, and we've been covering, and you and I have even been talking about it over the past several months since it occurred in October. And it does, you know, appear incontrovertible that Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, basically orchestrated this, ordered it, and saw it to its fruition. And Gina Haspel, the director of the CIA, briefed the Senate yesterday and briefed the Congress after initially denying that she would do so. And they actually passed a vote last week, a highly bipartisan vote, basically saying if we don't hear from the CIA about this, that we're going to potentially consider cutting off aid to Saudi Arabia in their war against Yemen. And so Gina Haspel goes yesterday and briefs Congress, and they all, the senators, you know, emerge saying, hey, look, Mohammed bin Salman is obviously responsible for this. And this is a break, really, from the first time we've seen from a large section of Republican senators with the White House. The White House has remained somewhat ambiguous as to whether or not, you know, Mohammed bin Salman was culpable in this. Maybe he knew it. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he did it. Maybe he didn't. That seems to be the rhetoric that we hear from President Trump. And yet now we see a large section of other Republican lawmakers kind of breaking with him and saying, look, this is without a doubt, there's hard evidence that MBS actually did commit this crime.
Well, and I admit, Drew, when I first heard about the killing, I didn't understand the connections or the implications because I was not terribly aware. And I wonder if many Americans are terribly aware of our support of Saudi Arabia and the war in Yemen. And so as this has unfolded, we're starting to see some pretty significant political pressure put on the president to intervene if the Crown Prince had a role in this murder. But one of those interventions might be our support of the war in Yemen. What are some of the implications? What options does the president have at this moment?
Well, I think that, you know, we can't eject our relationship completely with Saudi Arabia. We have a codependent kind of a relationship with them. We have mutual interests in the region. They rely on us for security. They rely on us for aid. We rely on them for intelligence and for a kind of a geographic partnership and diplomatic relationship in the region. And so it's unreasonable to think that we're going to completely cut them off. For something like this, we have to deal with difficult regimes throughout the world, and that's just a reality that we have to face. But I think there are things that we can and should do, and at the very least, if not imposing perhaps some sanctions, rhetorically condemning this and saying, look, that this is unacceptable, and you have to do this. With the dictatorships and with leaders, because if you give them an inch, they're likely to take a mile. And so that's why we have standards. That's why we draw red lines. That's why we condemn forcefully when this kind of stuff occurs, because even though it's a small, somewhat isolated incident, you may think it's just one journalist. What does it matter? Well, it matters because there will be another journalist. And it matters because there are other journalists all the time. Saudi Arabia is a very repressive, if not one of the most repressive regimes in the world. And so when they reach outside of their borders and kill people on foreign soil, and they kill a U.S. resident and a journalist and an employee of the Washington Post in Turkey and dismember him, you know, I think we should probably say something about it, because if we don't, they're not going to stop with just Jamal Khashoggi. They were sending a message, and MBS was sending a message when he did this to flex his muscles, to show that if you criticize him, he will come after you. He sent a message, and I think it's incumbent upon the United States and countries across the world to send a message back to him that kind of activity is unacceptable. So at least there should be, I think, an official statement from the White House or official statement from the State Department that condemns this, that assigns blame, since we have evidence, to MBS, and then potentially even impose sanctions if there's not some sort of acknowledgement on the part of the Saudis that this occurred.
Do you see that it might be difficult to reconcile this relationship long-term between the United States and the regime of the Crown Prince, given just sort of the gruesome and graphic nature of the crime? I mean, we could level some sanctions, we could do some of this, but this seems like it might be one of those things that could be a dark cloud for a considerable amount of time hanging over that regime in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I think it'll be a dark cloud as long as MBS is the Crown Prince, as long as he is in charge of Saudi Arabia. And it doesn't seem like that there's a way that he is not going to be. The King Salman has picked him as his successor, and so it's very likely for the next 30 to 40 years he could be in charge of Saudi Arabia. So it's something that we're going to have to deal with and contend with and manage. And even if it's not changed, and even if he's not changed, this is something that has to be managed. And I think that it's important morally for the world to know where America and where the West stands. And even though we may not be able to change everything and everything about the world, it's important to let them know that we have the world know that we have virtue. And people would criticize this as virtue signaling, right? You know, that you're just kind of making statements and saying, hey, we may not be able to change the outcome, but this is what we believe. But I think the only thing worse than virtue signaling is signaling to the world by your silence that you have no virtue, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very important that we maintain our stance and our place as moral leaders, and that we continue to articulate that moral leadership in the world against some of these leaders that we may not be able to do anything about them. They may lead for 30 to 40 years, but we know that the arc of history is long and it bends towards truth and justice and ultimately towards Christ. And so we need to stand for that and know that truth ultimately will prevail.
Now, we're talking to Drew Griffin this morning, who's the managing editor for Providence Magazine. Again, you can go to providencemag.com and read so many of the articles that are just, Drew, you guys do a great job there writing through some of the complexity of American foreign policy and keeping it from a Christian perspective. As we head into the holiday season here, Drew, do you have any sort of Advent kinds of practices that you do? Are you an Advent guy at all?
Yeah, I mean, we have an Advent calendar in our house. My daughter is already kind of monitoring that and filling it with little candles. And, you know, it's we've started reading the Christmas story through the Jesus Storybook Bible and those kinds of things. So it's, yeah, we have our own little traditions in the home as we kind of approach Advent and try and center the season around the arrival of Christ. So, yeah, it's a wonderful time.
Yeah, we love the Jesus Storybook Bible in our household, too, Drew. And so if we don't catch you again before Christmas, have a great Christmas and look forward to catching up again after the new year.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, take care.
We'll take a break here for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, I'll be joined by Galen Carey, who is part of the National Association of Evangelicals. We're going to talk about something that didn't seem like it should merit attention, about a tax levied on parking lots in churches, but it sounds like it has quite a bit of implications for the role of the federal government in the church. So it should be a good conversation in the second half of this hour on Faith Radio Mornings. I always love it when Ken Davis talks about dogs that way. And, you know, Rachel, I was reflecting on the fact that Drew Griffin was talking about having an Advent calendar in his household. And you mentioned a specific and quite interesting practice you did as a family with an Advent calendar growing up.
Yes, so they have these chocolate Advent calendars where there's these cute little doors and, you know, behind each door is a chocolate. And so they're marked for each day. And I, as a child, would save them up until December 24th and then I'd eat lots of chocolate that day.
It sounds like that sort of defeats the purpose of trying to be involved in Advent each day if you're just hoarding the chocolate, Rachel.
Yes, it does. So the chocolate didn't completely serve the Advent purpose.
I love it. Well, if you have some Advent stories like that and traditions, we'd sure love to hear them. We love Advent here at Faith Radio Morning. So call or text anytime at 877-933-2484. It's 877-93-FAITH. We'll share your traditions with others, too, as we continue to circle around this beautiful season. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, I was joined by Joe Smith, who has a parachurch ministry that focuses on strengthening the church, and he was talking about the cost of spiritual discipline and spiritual laziness.
I tell men when I talk about discipleship, they'll go, boy, so I really should be investing and growing and praying and studying and talking to someone else. That sounds like it's pretty costly. And I'll say, then you've listened well. Mm. What you haven't computed is that to do nothing has a cost. To spend your time watching ESPN and not investing in your family, there's a cost. Mm. So there's a cost either way. We men simply haven't computed the cost correctly, and we think it's all cost for spiritual growth, no cost to coast at home. Mm. There's always a cost. The question is, what's the best investment that reaps spiritual benefit to my wife, my children, my family, my workmates, my church, all those other kinds of issues?
appreciated Joe's perspective yesterday as he is spending the latter part of his life just ministering, avoiding the whole retirement syndrome and wondering what God has for him in the future. And part of that is to use the gifts and the experience that he's had to help strengthen our church. So if you want to catch that entire segment, you can go to myfaithradio.com and hear all of what Joe had to say yesterday. We've already been chatting this morning with Galen Carey, who is the vice president for the National Association of Evangelicals of Government Relations, and he does a lot of work with Congress. I'm going to ask Galen about some of these issues related to attacks on parking lots and churches next on Faith Radio Mornings.
We try to avoid pain at every turn, but might we be missing something? This is Jim Garlow. I don't know anyone who likes pain, but it's one of only two main ways we learn. The other is through the Word of God. God has given us both. Think of a father saying to his son, "Don't run into that brick wall. It will hurt you." But the son does run into the wall, bloodies his face, and breaks his arm. He has just learned not to run into the brick wall again. Now, he could have learned from his dad's verbal warning, but experience was the clincher. So the pain we encounter in life is often just the medicine we need to avoid sinning in the future. But if you'll just obey God's word to begin with, you might head off some of the worst pain. Consider that plan A. That's a whole lot better than plan B. Plan B hurts. Plan A works. This is Jim Garlow.
About 20 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and delighted to be joined in the line by Galen Carey, who is the Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of Evangelicals. Good morning, Galen.
Good morning.
So I was curious about some of the taxes related to parking lots and churches. And before getting into that, though, of course, today represents the day in which we're going to lay George W. H.W. Bush to rest. Any reflections on some of his legacy and leadership? You and I were certainly both alive during the time of his leadership. And just thinking back to the kind of character that he had, do you have some reflections from that time?
Yes, indeed. In 1992, the National Association of Evangelicals celebrated its 50th anniversary, and President Bush actually came to our convention to help us celebrate. And I was able to attend that convention, and I remember very clearly his message talking about faith and family and how critical faith and family are for the well-being and health of our country. So that's a theme, of course, that the National Association of Evangelicals has pursued and continues to pursue. And I think it's been very touching to hear all of the tributes to President Bush as being a man of faith and character and someone that led our country well and served us, and we're very grateful.
Well, he certainly was a model of what you just described in terms of family. When you see his children coming around him the way that they did, when you see his the longtime devotion that he and his wife Barbara had back and forth, it unfortunately seems almost to be a dying model to some degree in our country where you see such an emphasis on family like this.
Yes, indeed, and we're thankful for the models that we do have, and we pray that every couple will try to model the same virtues for their own children and for people in their community.
Well, certainly one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on this morning, Galen, was this idea about a church parking lot tax. And do I have my understanding correctly that as part of the tax cut bill that was released last year that cut a number of taxes in our country, some were hidden in this bill, or at least if it wasn't hidden, many members of Congress didn't know about it, was a tax, maybe a 21% tax levied on churches for parking lots?
Yes, indeed. In fact, it's not only churches, but all nonprofit organizations are now subject to a tax on the transportation-related benefits that they provide to their employees. It could be as simple as a parking lot. It could be a reimbursement of a bus pass or other transportation benefit. I've been in dozens of meetings in Washington with members of Congress and have yet to meet with someone who said that they knew that they were voting on a tax for churches. So it obviously some people knew because they put it in there, but it was very much buried in the text. And so it was quite a surprise. And in fact, even now, most church leaders are not aware of this tax, which went into effect last January 1st. And by now, there's already three estimated tax payments that have come due.
And is it a possibility at this point? I mean, President Trump is not necessarily known for understanding the minutiae and the details of different policy statements, and yet he was really obviously courting the evangelical vote in terms of gaining election. Is it possible he didn't know what was in this bill, or how are we understanding this situation?
It's very possible. I mean, I think it was a very large bill, and, of course, tax policy is complex. I think the important thing now, Peter, is that Congress, having realized that it made a bad mistake, it needs to fix the mistake, and they have an opportunity to do that. Senator Lankford is as a proposal in the Senate, and Congressman Walker in the House, that would repeal this tax on churches and nonprofits. And they'll be voting even next week, possibly, on some other tax items, and so this needs to be one of the things that the Congress fixes before they go home for Christmas.
Is this a situation at all, Galen, one of these times in which you can call your House of Representatives member or call the senator and exert some influence on that? Do you have some suggestions along those lines?
Yes, indeed. In fact, we have been told by quite a few people that that's the thing that would most motivate their members to act, is to hear from constituents who are concerned about this tax. And so, yes, both in the Senate and in the House, if people would call and say, just please repeal the tax on churches and nonprofits.
Well, and as part of this,
way to getting it done.
Yeah, and the importance of this, Galen, is it partially, yes, of course, related to the specific tax of the 21%, but even maybe more importantly, it's setting down a precedent of increased government involvement in the church, something that we're wanting to avoid.
Yes, indeed, because the calculation is complex, and so you can easily envision IRS agents coming into a church to say, let us look through your record so we can understand exactly how much you paid for that parking lot and what depreciation method you're using so that you can tell how much it's cost and how much did you pay for snow removal. And then this is just the camel's nose, and if the government can do that, what else can they do? And, of course, we know the power to tax is the power to destroy. So it's an important religious freedom concern as well for churches. But this also affects, as I mentioned, every nonprofit in the country, schools and charities of all types. And you keep in mind, Peter, that one of the impacts of the tax bill was to reduce the tax incentive for charitable giving because fewer people will itemize and the rates are lower. So charities are already struggling with the possibility of lower contributions, and then if they also have to pay tax and hire CPAs to calculate how much they owe, that's a double whammy for them.
Yeah, certainly as I sort of work around in churches and experience some different parachurch ministries and nonprofits, I don't see many that are entirely flush with cash. So this really is a situation that could relate to the future of many churches and many nonprofits.
Yes, and we don't want churches or nonprofits to be having to cut back just because they're spending their money complying with an ill-conceived government tax.
Talking with Galen Carey this morning, who's the Vice President of Government Relations for the National Associations of Evangelicals. And Galen, when we come back from break, we are referencing the character of George H.W. Bush earlier in this segment. And I want to get into that a little bit more deeply, because some interesting stats you've come out with relative to the importance that evangelicals place on moral character when it comes to leadership. So more with Galen Carey next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're chatting with Galen Carey this morning, who is Vice President of Government Relations for the National Association of Evangelicals. And Galen, some interesting statistics coming out recently about the emphasis that evangelicals put on moral character for those who are in public leadership. Tell us about it.
Yes, we ask our leaders how important they think moral character is on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most important or the very, very important. And the average came out to 9.4, which means, and the median answer was actually 10. So what we find is that evangelicals believe that moral character is critical for leadership. both in politics and in other aspects of society as well. As one person said, trust is a vital component of leadership. And quoting Teddy Roosevelt, to educate a man in mind and not in morals is to educate a menace to society.
Hmm. And in terms of the moral character, there's, I know, some people that would potentially push back on this a little bit and suggest that good character cannot overcome incompetence, and competence cannot overcome bad character. They do need to work together. But what kind of emphasis are people placing on sort of competence? And was that even part of how President Trump got elected? It was the perception that he would competently lead us in ways in which people were looking for, even having to overlook the poor character.
Well, yes, competence is critical as well, because without it, the best intentions will not have the results which are pleasing to God. So the two have to fit together, competence as well as compassion, conciliation, many other virtues. And, of course, our goal is to have people who would embody both. And I think, as we were saying before, President Bush did a great job of embodying both competence and character. And that's what we need to pray for our leaders, because they face incredible challenges. And so if we think that our leaders are not up to the standard that we want, we need to pray that God will help them to reach that standard.
Well, and certainly as evangelicals, Galen, I'd be curious your thoughts on, as we think about this moral character question, and we certainly live in a religiously diverse nation, is this one place in which, regardless of our religious framework and background and affiliation, that we can come together and say, boy, we really do want people of character? Because when you think about the Saudi Arabian leader, the crown prince, who brutally seemed to have murdered this journalist, that does play itself out in future forms of leadership. This is one place in which maybe we as a country can come together, regardless if we're believers or not, and say we really want leaders of good character.
Yes, indeed. This is something that this is a understanding that God has placed in our through the common grace that should be shared by all people. We may have some differences over what exactly it means to have good character, but there's a lot that we share. I was just reading in Psalm 24 this morning. Verse 3 says, "Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord?" Then it says, "Even he that hath clean hands and a pure heart." And that's, so it's a challenge not just for leaders, but for all of us, that we need to be people of character more than anything else. And if we get that out of balance, we can't expect that God is going to bless us.
Hmm. Galen, when I think about moving forward into 2019 now, and obviously you work with the government on a number of different kinds of levels, do you have some things that are first and foremost on the agenda that you want to get involved with on a government perspective from an evangelical perspective in 2019?
Well, we're always concerned about religious freedom. That's our number one priority, because without that, we won't be able to bless our nation in other ways. But we have a balanced portfolio. We're concerned about poverty, about human rights, about racial justice. In fact, we just released a document called For the Health of the Nation that outlines our priorities for public affairs. It's available on our website, and it actually, I think, lays out a pretty compelling evangelical agenda for what our country needs to be doing.
I see that one of the growing concentrations and majors at a university setting would be things around environmental kinds of studies. It seems like more and more students that I'm aware of are getting involved on some level related to our environment, climate change, all of those kinds of issues. How are you guys approaching this from an evangelical standpoint?
Yes, we believe caring for God's creation is how we describe it is extremely important. In fact, it's connected to other issues, because people who are most affected by if we have pollution and climate change and so on, are the poor. They are the ones that are least able to adapt to challenges and stresses. And so, caring for the world that God has made, and making sure that we are that we're leaving it in at least as good a condition as we found it to the next generation. That's an important biblical mandate, and it's one that we take very seriously.
Talking with Galen Carey this morning of the National Association of Evangelicals, working with government relations and thinking about advocating for evangelical issues on behalf of our churches in our country. And Galen, before we go here, we got about a minute left or so. Be curious if you have any specific Christmas songs that really dial you into the season. I know we've been asking all of our guests this question, and it's a range of answers. Do you have a sense in which, boy, when that song comes on, it really just gets my interest?
Yes, Joy to the World. It's a beautiful song, and it actually brings together not only celebration of Jesus' first coming, but the anticipation of his second coming and the time when sin and sorrow and thorns will no longer infest the ground. And to me, that's the great hope that we have that's captured so well in the lyrics of that.
Well, and certainly when we sing all the verses, of that song, we get a sense of both the anticipation of his birth, but also the anticipation of his coming.
Yes, yes. And that's the hope that we have as Christians, and it's what our nation needs, and it's what we need to be sharing with everyone that God puts into our path.
Well, thanks for the work that you do. Thanks for joining us on Faith Radio Mornings, and I hope you have a great Advent and a Christmas ahead.
Well, thank you. Same to you, Peter. God bless you.
We'll take a break here and wrap up our first hour in Faith Radio Mornings for the 5th of December. And I see that Bill English is already in the waiting room, and we'll bring him in at the start of hour two next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him. And heaven and nature sing.
Man, Rachel, you are on point this morning. Galen referenced Joy to the World, and you had it for us and our listening audience within 5 seconds. So well done. If you're listening to this morning, please call or text with your favorite Christmas music or Advent practices at 877-933-2484. Bill English up next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.